and Business and Labor to order. And we have with us today Mr. Cleary with Public Employees Retirement System. Anything else for the good of the order,
no.
Teresa? All right.
Thank you, Chair Schaffner, members of the committee. Paul Cleary, Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System, affectionately known as PERS. We appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning and share with you both where we are today, where we were in the past, and how we got here, and some of the improvements that have been made in the system. Also talk about some of the challenges that the market has thrown at us here in 2008. I've got a hard copy PowerPoint display for you. Not that I don't trust the technology, but I've discovered I've become conditioned to falling asleep during PowerPoint presentations, and that's particularly bad form if you're giving them. But if you'll join with me on page two here, just short overview of the system. Statutorily created in 1946. The focus, of course, is on our retirement benefits, but we also provide death benefits, both pre- and post-retirement, as well as disability retirement benefits. We cover about 95% of all Oregon public employees, 870 employers, state and local government, local districts, all schools. The primary ones that aren't included in PERS are some police and fire, local government police and fire units, the largest being Portland Police and Fire. $46 billion fund.
Paul, just a second.
Sir,
Paul,
thank you, Mr. Chair. How many employees is that
that we cover?
Yeah.
We've got about 320,000 members, and about 167,000 are actively employed, 48,000 are inactive, and that means that they spent some time in a covered position and now are working elsewhere, haven't retired yet. And then we've got 105,000 retirees.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And members, if you want to ask a question, I'm sitting way back here. Just let me know as we go along.
Right. Please feel free. $46 billion fund as of the end of November, as well as of the end of December. Things flattened out somewhat. Still one of the nation's largest. I think we're we used to be 13th. We're somewhere in the top 15 in the public retirement fund ranking, and we're in the top 30 in both public and private in the United States. Our investments are overseen by the Oregon Investment Council, staffed by Oregon State Treasury. My board consists of five members. They provide governance and policy oversight. One of them represents the members, a school teacher, Tom Grimsley out of Eugene. One of them represents employers, and right now that's Brenda Rockland, the president of SAFE. And then we've got three members that are unaffiliated, can't have any relationship with PERS, can't be a covered member, can't be a beneficiary, and right now that's James Dalton, Mike Pittman, and Eva Cripollani. Investments are a big key for us in the last 38 years since we started investing in equities. They've generated over 70% of our total revenue. Page three just shows some of the membership figures that we talked about. I would point out we've got 55,000 members that are eligible to retire. Almost 30% of the membership, and you can kind of see that graph on page three. This is our age chart, or our tidal wave, if you will, and you can see we've got a lot of folks in the prime retirement age, 53 through 63. And the question that we face is, are these people going to come out at $6,000 a year like they have historically, or is there going to be some trigger events that'll cause them to come out at $8,000 or $10,000 a year? We're a lot better if we do things on an even basis. This year, we probably won't hit $6,000, slowed down a little bit. We expect that's been a reaction both to the market as well as health insurance costs. One of the things that we do not provide at PERS is very much in terms of retiree health insurance. Pre-Medicare, prior to age 65, the retiree is responsible for their own premium. I know that there's some local government units and schools that subsidize a portion of those premiums. State of Oregon doesn't, but pre-Medicare, that $1,100, $1,200 a month or $800 a month, depending on your coverage, comes out of your own pocket. Post-Medicare, we provide a $60 a month subsidy towards the Medicare supplement. But that's one of the big differences between Oregon's retirement system and a number of the other nations'
retirement Representative systems. Representative Esquivel, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. But let's get back about the retired personnel in the state of Oregon, that they pay their own, which I understand that. But there's been an individual that's contacted me that worked for the state for a number of years, and he said that at one point they were in with the active people, and then all of a sudden they've been changed into a different bracket that's cost him personally $300 to $400 extra a month because of this administrative change. Why did we do that?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, I don't believe the state of Oregon has done. I know that. I don't know whether some of the other local governments have changed. The requirement in statute is that the employer allow the retired members to stay pooled with the actives.
Well, he's a state trooper, so
right,
it had
I'd
to have been
state. And I'd be happy to look into that particularly, but I've not heard of any type of change, and I'd be hearing about it.
Would you contact me? Because he contacted me from the coast and explained this, and it cost him $300 or $400 more a month, which he said, you know, that's pretty tough.
Certainly the premium has been going up. You know, when a lot of people retired in 92,
that.
It was 300 or so. Yeah, but I'd be happy to look into that for you. But
I have his name and everything if you'll contact me.
We'll stop by. Turn on page 4, just some statistics on our retirements. Again, we average about 6,000 a year. We did peak at 12,500 in 2003. Average age of retirement, about 59 years old. Average years of service, 21. People get to retirement before they get 30 years. A lot of people in public service come in and out of public service, come from other areas. Myself, I've got 19 years in Wyoming's retirement system and 13 in Oregon's, and I've discovered that doesn't equal 32. But, you know, I'm not unusual, and so you see that throughout our system. Average annual salary or average annual benefit for our 2007 retirees, about $29,500. That was 51% of their final average salary. Throw in a number.
What? How many retire at 100% or above?
Got a chart in here that'll show you that.
Oh, good, thank you.
Average annual benefit for living retirees, all of our 89,000 or so that are getting monthly benefits that we include in this study, about 23,300, and we've got a nationwide figure there of 21,800, a little bit higher than the nationwide, but again, one of the distinguishing features is we don't provide the retiree health insurance subsidies that a lot of folks do. Large amount of money that we pay out, about $2.4 billion paid annually to retirees living in Oregon, $400 million to retirees in 49 other states and $6 million in 47 different countries. We've got a map in the back here that shows you where the spread of the payments are, both within the state of Oregon as well as in the nation. This graph just shows the peaks and valleys and growth in our overall net plan assets. Again, as of the end of December, we're around $46 billion. During the 2000 through 2002 downturn, we had bottomed out at about $31 billion. So I just throw that out to show you we've gone through downturns in the past. We have recovered. We anticipate recovering from this one. We'd like to see a kind of recovery that we had in 2003. Not sure that that's necessarily in the cards right now, but we do anticipate climbing back out. I want to talk a little bit about what we were before the 2003 reform. I know a number of you were around during that session, and I know that there's certainly some disagreements over the methods. Hopefully most people can appreciate the outcome, because the outcome of that was that we stabilized our liabilities and we put this system in a condition that allowed us to weather this downturn in much better shape than we would have had we not taken some of these steps. But prior to reform, Tier 1, Tier 2 members, you get the best of three benefit calculations. I'm on page 6 now if you're trying to follow along. We had a full formula, formula plus annuity, and money match. We calculate your benefit on all three of those, and you got the highest. And it used to be that we were primarily a formula and a formula plus annuity system. Money match was just kind of percolating in the background. But then we had some really good earnings years, and we credited double-digit earnings to members. As a matter of fact, we did that average about 18% crediting for a four-year period. Well, that doubled members' accounts in 4 years. And that basically what that meant is you doubled people's benefits in 4 years. And the problem with retirement systems, you can set the benefit level at whatever you want. You just have to collect enough money over someone's career to pay for it, the money and the investments. And when you have something unusual like a doubling of a benefit in a four-year period, that meant you didn't collect enough money over someone's career to fund that. And as a result, we had a $17 billion unfunded liability that emerged, both because we also had declines in our asset values at the same time during 2000 through 2002, but it was primarily because we hadn't collected enough money over people's careers to fund benefits that we didn't anticipate. And I'll show you some charts here. Chart 7 shows the investment earnings, which are in the gray, versus what we credited to Tier 1 member accounts. And you can see good years, we pretty much tracked the earnings. We certainly reserved some over time. But then we got hit with these bad years in 90, 95, 94, 95, and we still have that 8% guarantee in there. And then, of course, we got hit with a huge downturn in 2000 through 2002. We're still crediting at 8%. We got into the good years again, and during those years, everything above the 8% we put into the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve and set that aside so we'd have it available to pay when we got into another bad year. You can see, though, it's one of the challenges I'll have here. You'll notice our worst year to date was still less than 10% decline in the regular account, and we're looking at close to a 30% decline this year. 27, I believe, was the final figure. I'll have to expand this chart in order to get that on, maybe go to a log scale or something. Earnings crediting for Tier 2 members is on page 8. And Tier 2 got what the market provided. They didn't have the 8% guarantee. They're the gray line. The dark line is the variable account. And that was invested solely in domestic equities up until a couple years ago when we moved it into a global equity portfolio. But again, it's 100% equity. So you can see it's bouncing up and down. And it had really good years, and it had really poor years. But this was the one where members took the risk and got the reward in the good years. Page 9 shows our retirement benefit calculation trends over the last 18 years. And you can see what I was talking about. The black boxes are the money match benefits. This was the retirement calculation that gave the member the highest benefit. So we were marching along primarily formula plus annuity with formula and a mix with money match. And then all of a sudden, because of those good earnings creditings and those doubling of accounts, we skyrocketed up where almost 95% of our retirements were going out under the money match formula. Now you can see how that's tailed off now. That was part of reform, was to stabilize the growth in those member accounts that were driving up those money match benefits. And you can see some of the success there. Eventually, we will become a full formula system, and for Tier 1 members, that gives you 50% at 30 of your final average salary at 30 years. For Tier 2, the same thing. For the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, the new program that applies to everybody who got hired after August of 2003, they will go out at 45% of final average salary with 30 years. Page 10, Chair Schauffer, you had asked about the number of retirees, what their average replacement ratio is, and you can see back in 2000, for our 30-year retirees, the dashed line
the average had become pretty much going out at 100% of final average salary.
But that was 30-year employees.
30-year employees, right.
What percentage of the, which goes back here?
Right, so the vast majority aren't 30-year.
Right.
So you can
Thank
see
you.
The dark line is what our average was for everyone, and there we'd gotten up to around 65%.
And Paul, I don't want to relive 2003.
Yeah, right.
Believe me.
Right.
We'll just move on.
Right,
here.
Right. But you can see kind of the stabilization where we've gone from there. Here's our employer rate chart. And, you know, we've averaged a little bit over 10%, bounced around some. One of the problems that we had, obviously, is in 89 through 95, when employer rates were dropping, or through 97, when employer rates were dropping, we had that liability emerging from money match. And it was like we were on the ocean. We saw the third of the iceberg that stuck out of the water. But we didn't see the two-thirds that was underneath of it. You know, certainly had we not dropped our rates during that time period, we'd probably been in better shape. Again, the whole idea is don't care what the benefit level is, you just got to collect enough money over someone's career and invest it properly to pay for it. And you can see we're dropping down this year. I'll go into a little bit of detail on that. 12 and 13, I only throw these out for your, you can read at your leisure.
Mr. Chair. Yes, sir, Representative Holby.
I just want to clarify. These charts don't look like they portray 2008. Is that correct?
Right. Well, it's based on the valuation year, which is the end of December 2007. That will be the rates that go into effect in the next biennium.
Okay.
Our rates will fall down 3% of payroll in this upcoming biennium. But they don't reflect 2008. The rates for the 11-13 biennium will reflect 2008 and 2009. So we've got some lag built in. Yes, sir.
Chair, a question. So on page 10, then, if let's pretend you were to graph this out and project, obviously, a speculative business, say,
right.
30 years from now. In time, these are going to trend to 45%. Is that correct?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Barton, certainly the upper line, the 30-year one, will continue to fall down as more and more people go formula. And so our 30-year retirees would be going out at 50%, Tier 1 and Tier 2. And then once we start getting a large number of new employee retirements, that'll drop to 45. But it'll be in that 45 to 50% range. The supplement for that is the individual account program that everyone is in. It's kind of a defined contribution type program where the member contribution got redirected as part of PERS reform, and that we project would get people somewhere in the 15 to 20% range. You know, retirement planners say, particularly if you're paying for your own health care insurance, that you need somewhere in the 80 to 90% range, you know, to continue the same lifestyle that you've got. We're not going to get you there with our system alone, so we do tell people, you know, they need to be taking advantage of other supplemental retirement systems as well, savings programs. Back on page 12 and 13, then, we just kind of run through some of the dates around PERS reform. I only bring this up because we're still having to do some work related to that. You can kind of see, you know, when the bills got passed and we did a number of actions, and then we had a court decision in March of 2005, upheld three of the key reforms, overturned two of them, and as a result, required us to go back and redo a lot of work. And on page 14, I kind of detail what that redo entailed, and you can see we've got that from 2005 to 2009. We actually had to go back and change the 1999 earnings crediting for 150,000 members, and we're having to recalculate benefits for 45,000 recipients. 21,000 of them were retirement benefits, but it also includes death benefits and redoing how money was allocated around divorces and things like that. So it's a pretty challenging effort, and we're in the final 6 months of that. But again, we've got some legal challenges still underway on that project. So I was hoping that by 2009, the 10th anniversary of the 99 earnings crediting, we'd be done with
that situation, but we still may be having to do some work in that area depending on a court ruling. So what do we look like today, Mr. Paul?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Paul, can we go back to page 11 just
yes,
real
sir.
Quick? The employer rate with side accounts, employer rate without side accounts. Can
right.
you explain the difference to what a side account is?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Cameron, certainly. The side accounts are where employer, what we call advanced deposits, and most of them came from pension obligation bonds, like the state of Oregon issued a $2 billion pension obligation bond. Those monies were put into a different account rather than their normal reserve, and they're invested similarly to the rest of the same as the rest of the regular account. And what happens there is they offset some of the rate of the PERS rate. So for the state of Oregon, the PERS rate for 2009 through 2011, that biennium, the upcoming biennium, the rate after the side account offset is going to be somewhere around 3.3% or so. The side account's offsetting almost 9% of that rate. It would be 12, but the investment proceeds and the amortization of that side account is what's depressing that. So you can kind of see the difference. The average rate without side accounts would be somewhere around 12%. Average rate with side accounts is down around 4%. And it's because of the way that we took those proceeds, stuck it in this account, and then we amortized that off over the same 20-year period. That we amortize the rest of our gains and losses, and the net effect of that is, in really good years, you get a pretty huge offset. Bad years, it's going to go down. Instead of 9%, we could get down to where we're only offsetting about 6% of the rate. So, you know, we've talked with the state budget folks about how, you know, we've got some savings in 2009 and 2011. Hopefully that will help at a time when the state is facing a revenue shortfall and we've got an economic downturn. But we do anticipate that our costs will go up in 11, 13, and we want to make sure that people have advance notice of that, and hopefully we'll see the economy turn up at that same time. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My pleasure.
Back on page 15, then, looking at our what we look like today. We used to have one major program, Tier 1, ran that for about 50 years. Tier 2 came in 96, and then we added two new programs in 2003. So all members right now participate at least in two programs. You're a Tier 1 member with an individual account. You're a Tier 2 member with an individual account. You're an OPSERP member with an individual account. And it's a challenge for members at times. Last year we were able to combine all their account information on a single statement, annual statement. We think that was very helpful. But I just want to make sure people understand what this current makeup is. What's our funded status? Page 16. We were in excellent shape at the end of 2007. We were 112% funded. By comparison, we were about 65% funded prior to the recovery in late 2002. So a tremendous turnaround in terms of our funded status. If we have a 25 to 30% investment loss for 2008, that funded status would drop, and we do everything on a fair market value basis here in Oregon. We don't smooth our assets and liabilities like a number of systems do. So what you're seeing here is the actual fair market value estimates. Funded status would drop to somewhere between 76 to 81% funded. Again, so what does that mean? That means for the benefits that we've already got on the books and the benefits that we promised, we've got 76 to 81 cents on hand. And we have to recover the remainder of that through either earnings above 8% over the next 20 years or increased member contributions. Again, the idea behind a retirement system, you collect contributions over a member's career, you invest those contributions, the combination of the contributions plus the investment earnings then fund the benefit going forward.
Well, I like to be an optimist, and I like that 112% funded number. In light of how many people we have, the graph back here, that are 50, 55, we're going to see a lump of people probably retire after things get better. I'm sure that's what they're waiting for. I would be. The 112%, that is a reflection of people, one, not retiring, and good returns, I would imagine, and the reforms, all though put together. Is that correct?
Chair Schaffler, the 112% certainly reflected good returns, and it reflects all of our liabilities. And we project those liabilities out for active members on a basis of how long we think they're going to continue to work. In some cases, people continuing to work actually results in an actuarial gain for us. Tier 1 members who are money match are some of your lowest cost members in terms of the retirement system because they get 8% in that account whether they're working or not. So you've got gains and losses. If people die early, you get a gain. If they live longer than you anticipated, you get an actuarial loss. So it's all continued to fine-tune. But, yes, we were 112 primarily because of good returns, and we were meeting our actuarial assumptions.
We've already heard one example of someone who at least perceives that they have been a reduction for whatever reason.
Right.
During the reform debate, and I'm not going back there, believe
me. Right.
There were a lot of people voicing their concerns about where they were at, what they retired at, and their worry. I had a woman in my district that said, well, I plan on traveling to see my daughter and my grandchildren, and now I'm not going to be able to. I may have some half. All those anecdotal stories, which I'm sure is truth in some, a lot of them, if not all. So my question, though, if, let's say, the way people are around this building, you're always looking to where they can get their hands on some money. Let's say it's 150% funded. We as a legislature cannot get at that money. Is that correct? That is stowed away.
Representative, you're correct. It's both a state and a federally protected trust fund. The way you get at the money when we have good funding, like we were when we set the rates for this upcoming biennium, is through the reduction in employer contribution rates.
Mm-hmm.
So it frees up money that would otherwise have to come to PERS, and that's what will happen this biennium. So certainly the state benefits when the system is well run and when we're generating the kind of returns we need. And if we run into an extended downturn, there'll be some additional costs to public employers throughout Oregon.
Thank you.
So I like to tell people, you know, there's a lot of folks on both sides of the coin that have got a vested interest in our success.
Representative Esquivel.
You just made a statement there that when you have a downturn, the employers in the state of Oregon have to step up what they contribute. Well, if it's a downturn and it affects them, how does that work?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, again, what we do is we base our employer contribution rates on the odd year valuation. So we're doing our rates for 2009-11 based on what did the system look like as of 12/31/07. We know 2008's been a bad year. We've got another year, 2009, before we do our next rate setting valuation. If 2009 sees a major recovery, the rates could go down 3% this biennium and then pop back up 3% next biennium, you'd be basically where you are today. 2009 doesn't see a major recovery, you could go down 3, pop back up 6, so you'd be about 3% above where you are today. What I'm hopeful for is that we've gotten linked up a little bit better with the general economy. So you remember in 2003, one of the problems we had is revenues were going down, PERS rates were going up. It seems like this biennium we're in a little bit better shape, or this upcoming biennium, where revenues are going down, PERS rates are going down with them. Revenues go up in 11-13, PERS rates go up at the same time. But the whole idea is we try to stabilize those rates as much as possible, but again, investment earnings
plus contributions is what funds benefits if investment earnings fall off for an extended time period. Now, over our history, we've averaged about 11% return since 1970, since we got into equities. Our assumption is that long-term we earn 8. So we get back onto that trend that we've historically had, and we'll recover out of this.
Paul,
yeah, please.
The reason I have a concern there at 2001 to 2003, I was on the Medford City Council, and at one time we had an unfunded liability of $26 million, whereas our annual payroll was $23 million, which meant that if we laid off every worker in the city of Medford for 1 year, we still would have to get out of pocket $2 million at that time. And I'm wondering, we're not going to get back to that situation, will we?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Esquell, no, we don't anticipate that. I mean, the part of what we did was, with reform, we stabilized liabilities, and with the actuarial rate collaring that we've got, we believe we've got in place an ability to stabilize employer rates. Remember, we were projecting employer rates this biennium prior to reform to be in the 27% range. We're now averaging 12% in the next biennium. So that's a huge difference.
Just to clear up my own foggy mind, but unfunded liability is projected out over many years.
20 years.
You're setting the rate, though, based on just 2 years, correct?
Right.
So that's why you see this.
Right.
You see the rate. But and I think this is lost on a lot of folks. The unfunded liability is stretched out over decades, not over a tiny little window. So when people hear, oh my God, unfunded liability, it's not as if that's going to happen tomorrow and you'd have to lay off every good worker in Medford to pay that. And that's one thing that frustrated me about the entire debate,
right,
and the talk about how many people were retiring at 100%. Look, you work 30 years in the labor's, actually it's 30 years plus 18, 30 years plus 50 years old in the labor's and you get 100%. Now, if you work in the labor's union for 30 years, by God, I think you deserve and you've earned 30% and 100%. And I have to say the same thing for state employees. So it was just a lot of hype,
right,
and I think a lot of this should have been settled at a negotiating table, and I didn't like the unilateral decisions on dealing with people's futures. It just frustrated me to no end. Now, I'm going against what I just said earlier. I do not want to relive 2003. But
I'm just going to remind you that.
You're reliving it.
Well, and certainly, Chair Schaffler, to your point, you know, we had a $17 billion unfunded liability in early 2003. We got back to where we had a $6 billion surplus in a five-year period. So we do. We amortize that unfunded liability over 20 years because, one, it helps us stabilize employer rates, and, two, it allows us to take advantage of market recovery. And, you know, we certainly expect, you know, several market cycles in that 20-year period. And people ask, why are you optimistic? And I say, all I do is look at my most recent history. I've got reason to be optimistic. And if I wasn't, you know, I'd have to hide all the razor blades. But, you know, in terms of how we compare to other systems, you know, we started the year at 112% funded. The average for public retirement systems in the U.S. was 86%. You know, we're looking at maybe sitting now somewhere around 80. The average for the rest of them is down below 65. So again, Oregon, you know, is in very good shape relative to other systems. Not as good a shape as we were relative to the end of 2007, but I don't think any investment account related retirement system, whether it's an individual IRA, 401k, or anything else, could withstand withstood certainly the market forces that we saw in 2008. Page 17 just kind of goes through our employer contribution rates again for 2009-2011. We're going to average approximately 12%. That's about a 3% of payroll less than the 2007-2009 biennium. They're based on the 12/31/07 valuation, so they're not affected by the market downturn. I'm just telling you, because of the depth of that downturn, we know that rates are probably going to go up unless we see a huge recovery in 2009. We don't anticipate that. We do collar those rates. Again, as I described, we're either going to pop down 3% in the 09/11 biennium and then back up 3 in 11/13 or back up 6 in 11/13, which would put us 3 above today. Side accounts, interesting dynamics. I'll come up with a better explanation of them. Maybe I'll do a graph for the next time. But but there is a dynamic there, and we try to make sure people are aware of that, that in the really good years, the benefits from the side accounts amplify. In the really bad years, they amplify in a negative fashion as well. And so, you know, we work with the employers. We did some major financial modeling on that, Representative Cameron, and shared that with all the employers, so they're aware of that. We try to make sure, you know, we just want to give people 3.5 years' notice as every time we get a chance of where things may be going.
And just to for future reference, so I can keep it clear too, and every employer have side accounts, and then I want to find what exactly is
right.
You know, you said bonds, but right. A side account. Where do you go get a side account?
Right. Chair Schaffer, no, not every employer has them. A large number of school districts do.
Mm-hmm.
State of Oregon. You know, I'm thinking that there's somewhere around 140 or so out of our 870, but I'll confirm that number. I know it's somewhere around $6 billion. Is what we had in those side accounts at the beginning of the year. Hot off the press, don't even have a page number on it, page 18. These are our returns through 12/31/08. And the reason that some of those numbers are fuzzy in color, they would be red. And you can see, if you look down, going down the left-hand side to the total OPERF regular account row, and it's the one that's got the big boxes around it, but the year-to-date and one-year return for that, that's the regular account, is about negative 27%. Now, that's our large portfolio. That's the totally diversified portfolio. You can see what those investments are in. We're in public equity. We're in private equity. We've got an opportunity portfolio that reflects a number of different investment vehicles. We've got fixed income. We've got real estate. And all of them are down. I mean, obviously, you can see the place to have been in 2008 was in cash in very short-term instruments. You know, relative to the kind of declines that you see in a total equity portfolio, like our variable account, and there we show you that it's about 42% down. You see the value of diversification. Unfortunately, in 2008, other than cash, there just wasn't much opportunity to make money anywhere. All the correlations moved to one. We've had this major decline. We call it earnings crediting, but obviously this year it'll be allocating these losses. And members who have just joined in the last 5 years who've never seen losses will probably be surprised. What we'll do now is, of course, the Tier 1 member regular accounts, they're guaranteed 8%. The way we'll fund that is we'll draw down this reserve that we build up over the last 5 years with their earnings above 8. When I started in this job in June of 2004, we had about a $1.9 billion deficit in the Tier 1 reserve. Over that five-year period, we filled that completely, and then we put another $1.9 billion on top of it. So we had about $3.8 billion in excess earnings on Tier 1 member accounts. They paid off their bill from the 2000 through 2002 downturn, saved up money for this, and we'll go through that entire $1.9 billion this year, no doubt about it, and we'll also create a new deficit.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I've just got a question about the I guess the policy and the target that you have listed under cash is being only 0 to 3%, and the target being 0% of having your portfolio in cash, I assume. Is that something that's mandated of the Public Employees Retirement Fund? Or, I mean, it seems like in 2008, as the market was changing drastically, that the fund would have perhaps put more money into cash to help mitigate losses.
Chair Schaffler,
hindsight's 2020, but I mean, I'm just curious.
Right. That's why the asset allocation policy is that range. Now, generally, you know, long term, you want to minimize your cash holdings because there's an expense to that. You got to have enough cash to meet your liquidity needs. And you know, we pay out $200 million a month in retirement benefits. We do bring in interest earnings on bonds, and we bring in some dividend income as well. And right now, it's matching pretty close. But long term, the policy is to try to minimize the allocation to cash. There is a target range there. You know, when we say the actual is 0%, it's because on a $40 billion fund, the rounding, a very small amount of cash, or, you know, what would be a large amount of cash for most anybody is still going to be 0% on a $46 billion fund. But, you know, we review these asset allocations about every 3 years. Because of this downturn, I believe the Treasury staff are recommending we take another look at this at the end of this year when we complete, which will only be about 2 years in between the last two reviews. But you know, they're continuing to you know, search for where can we get some return on active management, and where can we get return in terms of some of these other opportunities that crop up. But generally, you are going to try to keep that cash at a minimum to meet your, still have enough to meet your liquidity needs. But historically, it doesn't generate the best return. We just had this year; it was a good place to be.
Well, I guess my follow-up, Mr. Chair, I guess my question was, does the fund have the flexibility to look at this, and you know, even though it you do it only every 3 years, but right. and to the spring of 2008, could the fund have looked at this and say, the market looks like it's headed down for another year, maybe we should put some more money in cash? Do they have the flexibility to actually do that, or does the policy prevent them?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holy, under the Oregon Investment Council, they try to, you know, they set these policy ranges. Now, they, you know, obviously you could go up to 3%, and you could have had $1.5 billion in cash and not violated that policy range. Again, it's not set in statute. It does have that flexibility, but, you know, if we looked at it in the spring, we might have not done anything because you can kind of see from the bars below there, we actually were starting to see a recovery in April and May. Mm. Where the thing really fell off was September, October, November. And it was in that last, and December had some issues as well. But that was one of the challenges with this year, is we had some downturn real early, and then it looked like things were recovering. You know, hindsight, I wish I had that back then.
Wish we had some foresight.
There we go.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me briefly what the opportunity portfolio consists of? I was going to let it go because it seemed such a small percent, but then I realized there was $700 million in there.
Right. That allows us to get into a number of different type of investment vehicles. It would be distressed debt, could include commodities, could include, we don't have any in it right now, and that could include timberland investments. It's not an investment that particularly fits in one of these other asset allocations. So it's got a lot more flexibility in that area. It's a small, like you say, small allocation, but again, on a $50 billion fund, a small allocation can mean a lot of money. Yeah.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've always wondered this, and perhaps this question is better reserved for our treasurer. However, mm-hmm. I've always wondered why PERS doesn't invest in Oregon.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, PERS does invest in Oregon, certainly, and we invest in Oregon both through our public equity and probably some private equity investments, because we're in the market and a number of Oregon companies are on the market. And then there's also a targeted fund. And I'd be happy, Representative Thatcher, to ask the Treasurer's Office to come around and go through that with you in detail. I don't have that information right at hand, but I'll certainly get to them and have them come around and talk with you about that.
Thank you. So it just isn't apparent looking at this that there's any Oregon investment, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think we should invest in some timberland in Oregon, some agricultural land that needs water on it, and some industrial land just outside the urban growth boundary, and force this legislature to go out making money on that land.
Mr. Chair, I think timberland in Oregon would be a very poor investment.
Believe me, sir, I couldn't agree more in light of what we're at now. Paul, I do have a question. You go from roughly 27% down, and then 5 years out, 3.65%. Have you done any scenarios that would overlay the Great Depression years? What if we stuck here? Is this optimistic? Is this conservative? Where would you put this as far as projecting out?
Again, Chair Schaffer, this in terms of the market, biggest downturn since 1931. Okay, historical. We weren't a system until 46.
Right.
We started investing in equities in 1970. Between 70 and 2007, I haven't worked in the 2008 numbers, our average return was over 11%. So what you're seeing here is you see the lagging, the last 5 years' performance, and that's a challenge. You know, of course, it picks up that worst quarter in history, and you can really see where we fell off between the third and fourth quarters.
Unbelievable.
But, you know, when we look at 10-year numbers as well, and, you know, we want to see those 10-year numbers above 8% because that's our assumption. You know, I wake up January 1, and I assume that I've already earned $4 billion, 8% on 50 billion, and then I got to go out and earn it. So, you know, that we look at this from an 8% figure. Historically, we've exceeded that. This is certainly going to be a number that's going to take us a while to recover from, though.
Thank you. Well, go ahead, then.
So we look at page 19. We just talk about here how we're going to credit these accounts. We will use up the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve for those Tier 1 members. Tier 2 is going to have losses. The variable accounts will have losses, pretty significant. The individual accounts will have losses. And we'll have preliminary earnings crediting in February and final in March. These numbers recognize these. We've still got some updating to this 12/31/08 figure because our private equity and our real estate investments, the valuations lag by about a quarter. So we could see this go down a little bit more. And we'll keep you abreast of that as it occurs.
Mr. Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Paul, going back to the conversation about asset allocation, mm-hmm. Why wait until the end? And believe me, I'm not advocating that PERS or any investment fund really get into trying to chase the market
up and down.
But given the structural nature of this downturn and how profoundly different this one is than previous business cycles, why wouldn't you make a decision earlier than the end of this year? I think you referenced at the end of this year maybe making an asset allocation decision about how to shift.
Right. Chair Schaffler, Representative Edwards, what I've heard from Treasury is that they want to complete an asset allocation study by the end of this year, in the second half of this year. In order to do it, it takes some time, and we'd want to know whether they want to do it on our 2008 valuation, which we won't complete until
mid-July or so. They're continuing to review within these policy ranges, you know, the movement of investments. But a formal study is generally about a 6-month time frame to complete that, and you like to use your most recent valuation figures. You know, certainly we'll have conversations with them whether or not they want to do just a rapid assessment and maybe make some decisions based on that. But a more formal one, it would be difficult to complete it before September or so anyhow. Let's see. Retirees, I'm on page 20. You generally think that, well, retirees aren't affected by your investment losses because they've locked in their benefit. They're not affected by investment gains. We do have about 11,000 of our retirees, a little bit more than 10%, that stayed in the variable annuity at retirement. And that meant that they kept their variable accounts. And their benefit every year has been getting adjusted for either gains or losses. And you saw that one chart that showed the huge volatility in the variable account. Well, a negative 44% return combined, or 42% return combined with the fact that we'd already built in the assumed earnings rate, those retirees are going to see a 48% decrease in the variable annuity portion of their retirement. Now, that sounds like a huge amount. It may be for some. It averages about $200 a month, but anyone who's on fixed income, you know, $200 a month can be a significant figure. Those announcements go out February 1. I suspect I'll be getting some phone calls there, and I doubt it'll start with, I remember when you earned me 34% in 2003. But this does fluctuate up and down, and I just want to make sure you're aware of that in case you hear from people that PERS is cutting everyone's benefits and all the decisions that you made. And I think over time, those folks are still probably a little bit ahead. It's hard to say because it varies by individual. But
just for the record, Mr. Cleary, they were not decisions I made.
No. I mean, the individuals made to stay in the variable
annuity. Thank you very much.
All right. So I always like to end with a little bit of good news. You know, obviously we talk some about what PERS does in terms of drawing money out of employer budgets, but we also put a lot of money back into the economy. Again, our benefits paid in Oregon are about $2.4 billion. We used Bureau of Economic Analysis, Department of Commerce multiplier figures to come up with a total value of about $3.2 billion. That spending supports about 30,000 jobs in Oregon. And also there's a lot of income taxes paid on these retirement benefits, about $105 million a year paid here in Oregon. Page 22 and 23, just to show we do, I guess, spread the wealth.
I would just, before you go, move on. I would like to see something. You don't have to answer this now, unless you know it. You mentioned the income taxes. I'd also like to see what kind of multiplier effect this has on our state economy and people spending their money here.
Mr. Chair, that's what we've got. What we show is the $2.4 billion in direct payments.
Oh, forgive me.
Results in about $3.2 billion in total value. And generates that 30,000 job. It's the additional value is that $885 million in job in wages to jobs created by those benefit payments. So,
and how much goes out of the state?
We pay about $2.8 a year in total benefits. So about $400 million goes out of the state. 85% stays in the state.
Hmm.
You know, we've got a chart or we've got a map here that shows the distribution of our retirees' total payments and average payment by county. As you would expect, you know, the Tri-County metro area, Lane and Linn County, Marion County, areas where there's concentrations of public employment are where the vast majority of our retirement payments go. But they are spread throughout the state. Certainly, you know, Jackson County, almost $100 million a year in retiree benefits there, and even some of our lightlier populated counties, you know, $5 million a year paid to 300 retirees in Harney, for example. So you can kind of see the spread around the state. Nationwide, obviously, our neighbor to the north is where we've got a large number of retirees. You know, anecdotally, I think that people tend to retire where they lived when they were working, and we know we've got people that live in Washington and work in Oregon, both in, for state government as well as local government. But you can see folks have spread pretty much around the entire country. I think we're in all 50 states plus D.C., the fewest number in Delaware.
We've got Paul, three out there. This is the payments we make in these states.
Right.
Okay.
Right. What our spread of that 2.9 or 2.8 billion?
I would also be interested in seeing a map with the annual average annual payment of each of these states' retirement system is to their employees.
Chair Schaffer, I'll see if I can get that. I know I've got the national average figure, and it's gonna you'll see some spread there, but I'll work on that and see whether we can't find that information somewhere.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Paul, did the people in Washington pay Oregon income taxes on their Oregon retirement benefits? Because Washington has no state income. How's that work?
Right. Chair Schaffer, Representative Cameron, no, they don't.
So if I follow up, if I may. So if I work here, retire from here, move to Washington...
Right.
I can collect that without paying the 9% state tax.
Right, right. You won't pay the income tax on it. Oregon will make up for it by income taxing my Wyoming retirement benefit if I retire in Oregon. So it works both ways. We've got probably some Washington retirees over here, but no, we don't collect that. And that's about a total of about $400 million that's paid to people that aren't living in Oregon. We've looked at that. It's kind of a challenging factor, but I'd be happy to sit down and talk with you. I know legislatures looked at it in the past.
Just a note of it, over a third of it's going to Washington.
Right, right. Again, I think you know, reflects that you've got a lot of people that probably lived in Washington when they were working in Oregon throughout their career. I'm not sure that a lot of them moved there, but certainly we've got some that moved there.
But they're all coming here buying their cars and their groceries, so we don't
need to do that. We get some of it.
Anyway. We get a lot of that, too.
We get some of it.
Forgive me for...
No problem. And just like to end with, you know, our trend in our customer satisfaction survey results. We do these every year. I'm pleased to see that we've got improvement with our members and our retirees across the board in how they rate our overall service, our timeliness, accuracy, and so forth. Employers, improving trends, except in two areas. We had some real challenges this year with our employer reporting system slowing down in the summertime, and we've worked on the infrastructure for that, but that's why we think the website and the recent service versus pass showed a decline. But in general, to move from around 65% 3 years ago to close to 80 or 90%, for the members and get up above 70 for the employers. I'm really pleased with those trends. I would note that this is before we send out the 2008 statements, so we hopefully we won't see too much erosion there. Legislative concepts. As an agency, we've only got one bill, and a pretty simple bill. It would allow us to treat people who retire on a lump sum payout the same as we do people who continue to receive monthly benefits in terms of them returning to work. Right now, the statutory provision for people who return to work is you can return to work for up to half time. It's 1,040 hours. We tell people 1,039 so they don't cut it too close. But you can work 1,040 hours and continue to receive your retirement benefit.
you work beyond that, we have to stop your retirement benefit, unretire you, and make you back into an active status. There are various exceptions for that that the legislature's applied over the years, but that's the general rule. Doesn't apply to people who take a lump sum payment, and our bill would make it consistent throughout. We do know that there will be some other concepts from stakeholders. We just saw, I believe, yesterday the first one that's actually filed, but we could have bills that deal with variable account transfers. Right now, if you're in the variable account, you have to wait until you're 50 years old to transfer out. Well, because people have seen some pretty tremendous volatility and indeed the losses in 2008, we may have people that are 40 years old that just soon say, hey, you know, I like that volatility when it was up. I don't like it when it's down. I want to get out. And that bill would allow them to transfer to the regular account. And we also would expect we might see something from the retirees who made a decision to stay in and now are having some second thoughts. We expect that we'll see exceptions to those return to work limits for retired members. This is one, you know, we'll spend a lot of time with our actuary on. Right now we've got about, I think system-wide, around 10,000 retirees that have worked some amount of time this past year. Now, that could be working 5 hours, or that could be working half-time, but say 10% of our retirees. We get a large number, it could start impacting our employer contributions, because if they're retired, we don't collect money on their salary. If they're replaced with somebody who's working, we collect money on that salary. Again, it's been a small enough number now, it hasn't moved the needle, but we will be, if we see a large number of bills or a bill that affects a large class of employees, we're going to have to spend some time with our actuary and make sure that we give you the kind of information you need to make the right decision. And there was talk about an ad hoc COLA increase. Right now, our retirees get the up to 2% annual cost of living adjustment. It's based on the consumer price index for Portland. If the CPI is above 2%, they bank that difference. Say you have a year of 3.5, we only give them 2. They bank the 1.5 for years when it falls below it. Numbers I'm seeing now is it certainly is going to be below 1%, could be a tenth or three-tenths of a percent, again, because of the deflationary fourth quarter. But I'm not sure whether that bill will necessarily be introduced. The issue we've got with ad hoc COLAs, and the reason we use that term, is we haven't pre-funded them. So we have to look at them from a funding status. The rest of that 2%, we've collected money over time to pay that. I just bring that up because I wanted to close with our legislative review process, and one of the components of that is when bills come in, we've got to have a little bit of time to do an actuarial analysis, and we also have to look at bills from a standpoint of will it affect our federal tax qualification, and we want to make sure that we give you guys the information you need to make the right decisions, and that we've identified to the extent possible all the unintended consequences. So we use an advisory committee, we use an actuary, we've got again federal tax council, and we're trying to anticipate bills, but until we actually see them, it's kind of tough for me to tell my actuary, give me a cost estimate on this. So
before I go to Representative Cameron, how much time do you need?
Generally, if it's things that we've got that we've looked at in the past and we've got the modeling capability for, you know, we can do it pretty quickly. You know, certainly we can do it within a two-week period. It's if it's something that we've not seen before, it could take us up to a month or so. So, you know, we like advance notice. We try to get the stakeholders to share concepts with us. And
believe me, you'll get as much advance notice as I get.
Yeah, right. I understand.
Mistakes either. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Paul, just on the variable account transfers, on that legislative concept, is that right now in statute that they cannot do that?
Chair Schaffler, Vice Chair Cameron, certainly it is in statute now that you have to be 50 years old to transfer. It used to be you had to be 50 and your variable account had to have earned as much as it would have otherwise in the regular. It was the idea that, you know, don't let people take all the gains and then lock in those gains and move it, you know, beyond what they would have earned in the regular. And so 2001, they got rid of that particular test, and we just lock in whether it's a gain or a loss. But they kept the 50-year age restriction, and you know, talking with staff, I'm not sure that there was any real policy reason for it. And now that we lock in gains and losses, I don't believe we'd have any issues with it. And again, it just gives people flexibility. You know, from an investment standpoint, you probably hate to do it, you know, in the fit of emotion once you get that member statement, but because, you know, again, our experience is we do get retreats to the means. If we've had really high earnings, it tends to retreat back down. If we've had low earnings, it tends to come back up. So, you know, but we will have folks that will be interested in that. And it is it's a statutory restriction right now.
Thank you.
It has to be age 50.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kinnaman.
Ms. Cleary, as a new PERS retiree, I just wanted to commend you and your staff on your quality of customer service. It was an interesting thing to be in the process of retiring and have lots of questions, some a bit naive, some a little complicated, and I felt really confident with the answers that I got, and when there was a question they didn't know the answer to, they moved up the line and got it in a speedy fashion, and I thought that was real exceptional.
Well, Chair Schaffer, I appreciate that, and I certainly will pass that on to our phone staff and our retirement application assistance staff. We do appreciate the support of this body. Last session, we got added a couple of positions, and I redirected four in the agency to provide one-on-one application assistance for folks because it's not simple. I'd love to make it a lot simpler, but you've got 13 different options that you got to evaluate, and you're making a decision that you know, gets locked in for the remainder of your life. So, we offered, I think we offer about 3,000 of those sessions across the state, and we've got really good take-up rate on it. So, more than half of our retirees are going through it, and that's something that you know, the legislature, in their wisdom, said, "Hey, you got to get back into doing that." We hadn't done it for about 6 years, and we really paid the price for it. So, I appreciate the good report, and I'll pass that on.
And thank you for that, Representative. I think you're doing as good a job as you can. And I met Mr. Cleary in 2003, and he was head of the Water Resources Department. So it seems like you're always taking on these incredibly troubled roles. So I appreciate that. Any further questions of Mr. Cleary?
You know, Chair Schaffler, I noticed that when I was at Water Resources, people thought I was a heck of a lot better director in the wet years than I was in the drought year. And I'm afraid that the same thing's going to be used.
Yes,
there's an analogy.
There is, no doubt about it. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And we'll get around and see some of you, and we'll get back on the questions, too. Thank you.
All right. Next is Mr. John Schultz with the Workers' Compensation Division.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz with the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and it's a pleasure to be here today to give you a brief overview of the workers' compensation system. You've got a packet of materials and handouts in front of you, and I'll be referring to those as I go through this presentation, and I'll touch on each one of the handouts. But first, let me give you some background about workers' compensation here in Oregon. By law, Oregon employers must carry workers' compensation insurance or be self-insured. And Oregon has had some kind of workers' compensation program since 1914. Basically, the system is an agreement between employers and workers where workers forego their right to sue employers for on-the-job injuries and illnesses in return for a set level of benefits provided through the employer's purchase of workers' compensation insurance. Workers' compensation insurance is there to protect workers and employers by paying for the medical treatment and lost wages of the worker, as well as protecting employers by shielding them from those liability lawsuits I talked about a second ago that could result from work-related injuries and illnesses. Employers pay premiums typically to workers' compensation insurance companies, and those premiums finance most of the benefits received by workers if they're injured or suffer an occupational disease on the job. The other option here in Oregon is self-insurance. The legislature, yourselves, make the laws that determine the level of benefits and who qualifies for those benefits. The Department of Consumer and Business Services regulates the Oregon workers' compensation system and makes certain that employers provide insurance for their workers. We ensure that injured or ill workers receive the benefits that are due them and that they receive them on time. We provide reemployment services as well as dispute resolution when disputes arise, to mention a few things. Our system today in Oregon is designed to prevent or reduce worker injuries and illnesses, to provide appropriate medical treatment and benefits to help workers recover and return to work as soon as possible, and to resolve those disputes that do come up quickly and fairly. Now, some of you probably know that just 20 years ago, the Oregon workers' compensation system was in trouble. The cost of workers' compensation premiums in Oregon was the sixth highest in the nation, and benefits to workers were well below the median of other states. Accident rates, injury rates, and fatality rates were all high in this state. In 1990, and again in 1995, the legislature enacted major reforms to restore some balance to the system and to try to address the problems of the Oregon workers' compensation system. The legislature also asked that the two main stakeholders in the system, employers and workers, to evaluate future changes to the system by creating the Management Labor Advisory Committee. And since then, and I think if there's any other message you walk away from today that I would like you to remember, is this: that injury rates in Oregon are down. The base rate and I think this is the best news of all, by the way. Between the late 1980s and 2005, accident and injury rates went down by 50% at a time when employment in the state nearly doubled. And fatalities are significantly lower. In 2007, we had among the fewest fatalities ever recorded in Oregon. The cost to employers is also down. The base rate for Oregon employers, what they pay for workers' compensation premium, it has dropped to among the lowest in the nation. 2009 marks the third straight year for a rate decrease and the 19th consecutive year with no rate increase or rate decreases. There's no other state in the nation that comes close to that. But that's not the end of the story. Worker benefits are up. At the same time, benefits to injured workers have significantly increased. Temporary wage replacement benefits when workers are disabled from their job, and permanent disability benefits are now among the most generous nationwide. And very importantly, workers go back to work faster. Workers are getting back to work faster than ever, in part because injury severity is down, and also because of successful reemployment programs and a partnership between employers, labor, and physicians to concentrate on return to work as part of the treatment plan rather than just an adjunct to the system. So I told you I would mention some of the things in the folder. The first is probably what we refer to as our workers' compensation Bible. It's got all the facts and figures about the Oregon workers' compensation system that most people could think to ask. And trust me, if you look through this, you'll find some things that you probably wouldn't have thought of. This is basically a report card on how the Oregon system is doing on a wide variety of topics. And we have been putting this, the department has been putting this out for several years now. But it covers everything from compensability rates, which is a code word in workers' compensation for the number of claims that are accepted for workers who are hurt on the job, what's going on in claims processing, safety and health, return to work, how much benefits are being paid out, disputes, the insurance system itself. There's just any number of tables and articles in there that is good resource material. At any time that you have any questions, by the way, I'd be glad to help with that, so you don't have to pour through the report yourself.
John, I remember, I don't know, maybe it was 2003 or 2005, but I saw a slide of Oregon compared to our neighbors, and our rates were radically, and still are radically, lower than our neighbors, if I'm not wrong. But on page 82, it shows 2008, we had, is it 39th, that's the lowest, 39th lowest average premium rate ranking in the country, so there's only 11 other states that have a lower ranking.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And that actually is a little bit higher than where we were during the last session. We came up a little bit mainly because other states had lowered their rates. What is not shown yet is the 5.9% decrease that we have implemented for 2009, which my guess is going to drop us down even further.
I would also like to see if whenever you get around to it, I would like to compare our level of benefit to those 11 states that have a lower rank and premium than ours. And I might add, too, a lot of the decreases you talked about in injuries and fatalities are due to We've really carried on quite a program of working with employers and labor to be conscientious of their work environment and try and make it a safer place. And that's just, you can't really quantify how much money you save and how much pain you avoid by doing those kinds of things.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I can provide information comparing some of the benefit rates. Sometimes that gets a little bit to be apples and oranges between states, but in some of the areas, especially temporary disability and permanent disability rates, which compare very nicely across the states, Oregon is quite high in the benefit amounts. And then you're right about the safety victory, really, that's gone on here in Oregon. It's a partnership between Oregon OSHA, the insurance companies, employers, and labor. A complete cultural shift in the benefit of safety in the workplace over the last 20 years, and some of the tables in here that you can take a look at is one of the ones that I think is most important is the drop in fatalities in Oregon. You can argue about what's a claim and what's not a claim. It's difficult to argue about whether someone was killed on the job or not killed on the job, and the fact of the matter is that workplaces in Oregon are tremendously safer than they were 20 years ago.
Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could you comment on the timing of when those rates have gone down? I mean, the question in my mind that I'm driving at is how much of that is correlated with a shift in the makeup of our economy. I mean, we've lost thousands and thousands of jobs in the woods. And working in the woods is probably the most dangerous profession that we have in this state. So I'm wondering, is there a correlation with that, or could you just speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I get asked that question on a fairly regular basis, and we've done some studies of what we call the hazard mix of business. And has Oregon really experienced overall a less hazardous mix of business? And the answer to that appears to be that no. While the employment in the woods has dropped dramatically, much of that was replaced by employment in construction, which unfortunately produces as many injuries as employment in the woods traditionally. So the hazard mix of business, and that's just a very simplistic comparison.
Sure.
The overall hazard mix of business in Oregon has stayed about the same over the last 20 years.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you bring up a valid point. In the 70s, I was involved in wood products where I managed mills and veneer plants and sawmills, but the dramatic change actually happened in the 70s. We, as companies, decided and embarked upon guarding, embarked upon cleaner a work environment. Some of the mills that you used to see were very filthy, whereas we ran mills that were almost cafeteria type, where you could walk anywhere in that mill without having to walk past debris, and everything was guarded to the point of where you'd actually virtually have to work at getting into a sprocket and or electrical motor or a key or whatever. But I think the 70s was the big change in the industry, and then the education part came in the 80s. And I think compiled with those two, you put those two together, those two eras together, I think that's the results of what we have today, was the fact that the employer was more conscientious and the employees were more conscientious, because at that time 85% of all work-related injuries was due to people not thinking. They would just get used to a piece of machinery, and a piece of machinery has no conscience. It will bite you, and it will bite you severely. And I think that's where we embarked upon not only the guarding systems, but also the education part of it. Is that pretty much it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, I think that's a pretty good description. There was a combination of hazardous conditions that were abated, as well as unsafe acts that began to abate as well. Both employers and employees learning to act safely, and I think there was a cultural shift away from allowing for the unguarded, hazardous environments to much more of a safety-conscious environment. And I think many employers recognized that their employees were their most valuable assets, and they wanted to preserve them. We started seeing employers investing in return-to-work programs, bringing their injured employees back to work, so that we didn't see the long-term claims where people were off on time loss for long periods of time. They were coming back to work much more quickly in positions that were physically appropriate for them to do. And there were a lot of activities that were different. And I think Oregon has benefited from that, and there's been an ongoing, basically an ongoing use of that learning in Oregon. And as you can see, we've benefited from that for many years now. But yes, I would agree, Representative. That was a big part of it.
Oh, Representative Holden.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I don't know if it's in this thick pamphlet that you've given us, whether there's any charts on the percentage of claims that are accepted versus denied, and also how that compares to, I'd be curious how that compares to other states.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, there is, and if you bear with me for a second, I will find that. It's in the compensability section. What we have been seeing is a slow but steady drop-off in the last few years of denied claims.
I believe it's up on page 24.
In on 24?
I think so. This is a section on claims processing.
Yeah, I think you're right.
24?
24.
She usually is.
Yes, she is.
There's also a chart on page 21 that I'd probably bring your attention to.
Please.
It's page 21, it's the top chart, it's total reported claims, and it has a lot of different information in here. First of all, what you would note there is the number of accepted disabling claims has dropped by more than half in the years between 1989 and 2004. My edition is old. Hopefully you've got newer editions. But to your point, Representative Holvey, the percent of denied disabling hit a peak about 90, 91, 92, and since then stayed rather stable at about 17-16%. But we started seeing it going down about 2004, and over the last 4 years it has dropped down to about 14% of the claims that are being denied. Now, how that compares to other states, I'd have to get back to you on that, because I don't know that one off the top of my head.
And why is that drop and then the flattening out of it? Why did it go from 20 in 92 down to 14 in 2008, and why is it flattened out?
Yeah, the early high rates were due to claims practices at Safe Corporation primarily that they changed rather quickly in the early 90s. And then we saw a long stable era of about somewhere between 16-17% of claims being denied. What we have seen most recently is an interesting phenomenon where the initial claim, what we call a whole claim denial, that those have been dropping off very rapidly. And what we're seeing is partial denials actually overtaking whole claim denials. And what that means is that a part of the claim that the worker may bring forward is what's being denied, but not the whole claim. So let me try to give you an example of that. The worker might file a claim for shoulder, elbow, and wrist, and eventually there's a denial on the wrist because it involves a pre-existing condition, which becomes the major contributing cause for the need of treatment on the wrist, whereas the elbow and the shoulder remain completely accepted by the workers' compensation.
You're bumping
area.
Into medical sequelae, and we're not.
I won't start on sequelae.
I beg you.
I promise you.
We may return to it. I understand so, but not today.
I won't bring it to you.
Thank you.
Something else I wanted to share out of the handouts is actually lessons learned from Oregon, and it's on the right side of your page. This is excerpts from a national group, the Workers' Compensation Research Institute, that studied Oregon's success and wrote a manuscript about this and published it for the rest of the country. This is the executive summary from that. And I just want to read very quickly to you from the executive summary, the first paragraph, which goes on to say, state policymakers often want to learn more about the system in Oregon, a state with a reputation for achieving certain desirable outcomes, including reasonable income benefits that are typically delivered accurately and promptly with lower litigation levels and employer costs that are affordable and stable. If you didn't know, Oregon has a very good reputation around the country in terms of its workers' compensation system. And this study cited that there were four lessons that the rest of the country would do well to learn from Oregon, and those were that the Management Labor Advisory Committee system here in Oregon works to review and make recommendation about system changes, and that was one lesson.
Before you leave that, the governor, who was instrumental in Mahoney Hall and reformation of all this, has a policy that I completely agree with, just for, and I don't know, you may all be aware of it, that he'll veto any workers' compensation bill that comes to his desk that has not went through the MLEC process. So I just wanted to throw that out there in case anyone comes to your office asking you to do something. It has to go through that process first, and I totally agree and support that process. Because we have a lot of new people in the legislature, and
right.
They may as well know about it right now.
Right. And the Management Labor Advisory Committee, or MLAC, is made up of five management members, five labor members. And they work for you to and the governor to review workers' compensation bills. And some of those bills can take many, many hours of public hearings in front of MLAC, and they help get those into shape and make recommendations to you about those bills. The second lesson was a high rate of accurate and timely benefits for workers. Oregon has extremely high rates of accuracy on benefits and timeliness of those benefits for workers. A system of reduced litigation in comparison with other states. One of the objectives in the OIS Chapter 656, which is the workers' compensation law, is to reduce litigation. And we have greatly reduced litigation in the Oregon system, and part of that is because we do so much mediation and administrative dispute resolution.
John, is there any number out there that can show how much money business is saved or workers saved by avoiding litigation? Is there anything out there?
For the premium that hasn't been paid because of all of these changes, we have a number. Now, zeroing that into the litigation itself is difficult to do because we made so many other changes at once. It is difficult to identify one change and come up with a number for it. What is typically saved for both workers and employers is a lot of time. We are usually able... An example would be a dispute over permanent disability benefits. When a worker has, because of their injury, has a permanent disability, they may be in dispute over the finding of what that compensation should be. What body parts are disabled? How much impairment was there? Are they really disabled? And disputes arise. That's a very common area for litigation across the country. In Oregon, the first step in resolving a dispute like that is not to go to a hearing and litigate the claim. The first step is to gather the record in an administrative process and to have an administrative review that offers mediation. If the parties do not want mediation, then we go to more of an arbitration model where both sides present their arguments and an order is issued. All of that takes about 90 days at the most, and many of those are done much quicker than that. 90 days is the slowest it ever occurs, and in fact 100% of those decisions administratively are done within 90 days. I would dare say that at 90 days to set up to go through a litigation process, you might have your court date penciled in at that point. So the speed of resolution is I think very important for workers and employers to be able to move on. Secondly, there are savings involved in that process. Again, how much we can attribute to that versus everything else, I don't know. But we do have information about the amount of savings in terms of premium that Oregon employers have saved since the beginning of these reforms, and it's well within the $60 billion range that Oregon employers have not had to pay because of these reforms. The last thing that the WCRI report pointed out was successful return to work programs, which is actually something very unique to Oregon. Most other states don't have the degree of our return to work programs. The Workers' Compensation Division has requested four bills this session, so we'll be coming in front of you on four bills. I have one pagers here in your materials on those bills. They're HB 2195, which is essentially vocational assistance streamlining. My pages are sticking together here. Bear with me. There we go. HB 2196, which is in regard to workers' compensation forum for disputes. HB 2197, workers' compensation general regulatory streamlining. And SB 110, which is probably the most substantive bill, has to do with workers' compensation death benefits for those workers who are actually killed because of their injuries. And that bill was put together by MLAC at the request of the Senate last session, and it increases the death benefits to certain injured workers.
And it's a safe bet all these bills will come right straight here, so I encourage my members to read up on that and ask any questions they have of you on those.
And Mr. Chair,
includes me.
And Mr. Chair, the Management Labor Advisory Committee has approved those, recommended those bills forward. As we talked about earlier, the Management Labor Advisory Committee is a key part of the system. We have a handout about the Management Labor Advisory Committee. It's on their letterhead, just for your review. I've provided that. MLAC is ready to review and make recommendations to you on this session's legislation. So if there are issues that you want them also to consider too, that's something that of course we can arrange through Teresa, and we can certainly talk to MLAC about that. I also want to mention the Workers' Compensation Board. I don't want to leave them out. They serve an important role resolving disputes in the system. The board conducts hearings, mediation, reviews appeals, and approves claim disposition agreements. That's the litigation after the first step with us. I have included as well a contact sheet for you that has my name on it, as well as two other names, and I want to introduce two people from our department that serve as independent advocates from my division. They're independent from my division. They are Jennifer Flood, our ombudsman for injured workers. Her office advocates for injured workers in their dealings with the system. It can often be complex, and workers need assistance. David Waukee is our small business ombudsman. His office helps employers with workers' compensation insurance issues. And my phone number, Jennifer's and David's, is on the contact sheet. And if you have constituent issues with workers' compensation, which come up a lot, please don't hesitate to call us. We're here to help. The last
point I want to make is that I included a handout on the department's strategies. I wanted to provide you with this copy because it's not just about workers' compensation. It's about the Department of Consumer and Business Services, our strategies and accomplishments. And the publication highlights more than just what the workers' compensation divisions work and what we're doing. It focuses on the whole agency and the regulatory work that we do and how we oftentimes work together. So, with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any further questions of Mr. Schultz? Well, we got him here. We will be seeing him again. I'm confident of that.
We see a lot of John, don't we?
But Senator Benjamin.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say for the record that when I commented earlier about the danger of logging jobs, I certainly meant no disrespect or to my friend sitting here to my left is a fireman, and for all I know, has a more dangerous job than the jobs in the woods of today, certainly. So,
well, I took it that way, but at least it did too. Anyway, all right. Thank you, Representative. I'm sure everyone here knew that. Thank you for pointing that out. Any other further questions? All righty then. Well, Mr. Schultz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Look forward to working with you.
Members.
And you did a great job during the interim taking care of all our problems. I really extend my appreciation for that.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Okay. So if there's nothing else, Teresa, do you have anything else for us?
I do not.
All right. Well, then I will.